Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is David Farrier. David is the author of Anthropocene Poetics, Postcolonial Asylum and Unsettled Narratives. He's written for Aeon and The Atlantic. Chair of Literature and the Environment at the University of Edinburgh. Today, we'll be talking about his new, and I think most accessible book, Footprints, In Search of Fossils, published in March by Farrar, Strauss, and Giroux. So, we live in a world of plastic, concrete, steel, paper, and other detritus of a civilization that did its best to despoil our planet, endanger our descendants, and take a beautiful and sleek spacecraft and metamorphosize it into a kind of traveling garbage bin. So perhaps stated a bit overmuch. But David, in gentler words, paints a picture of a future in which archaeologists comb through the remnants of our rubbish, or what will be rubbish, and find in fossil form evidence of a long gone civilization and who we were and what we left behind. So welcome, David, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. Good to be here, Sam.
Likewise. So, you know, your background is in English literature. So let's begin with the idea of Italo Calvino's quote that if we eventually saw one city or a city appeared before us, we wouldn't be able to perhaps identify even the fact that it was a city.
Yeah, the reason that I got into thinking about what our future fossils might be is because it occurred to me that the legacies that we're creating are stories that we're telling to the future, the material legacies that we're leaving, whether it's the carbon that we're putting into the atmosphere, the plastic that we're distributing around the planet, the 130 million pieces of space junk orbiting the Earth, or indeed our cities, which is where Calvino comes in. They're all stories, they're all legacies written into the Earth that will, as you say, tell future generations stories about us, who we were, how we lived, what we valued. And I thought, we need to grasp that. We need to grasp that idea that we are telling stories. All the time in the way that we treat the Earth. We're telling stories about what we do and don't see, what we do and don't value. And to think about these as stories told to the deep future, I think, helps us to appreciate the urgency of the kind of climate crisis that we're dealing with, that we're confronting. And that, you know, that's where I come in as somebody who works with literature, who teaches literature every day. And you know, for whom literature is my kind of bridge into meeting the world and thinking about it. So it's thinking about this as a kind of engagement in storytelling of various different kinds seemed a very natural way to address these questions. And that's where people like Italo Calvino come in. So, you know, when one of the questions I ask in Footprints is, you know, what kind of fossil will a megacity like Shanghai leave? What kind of traces of how we've lived in these huge conurbations, these huge concentrations of people and materials and technology, what will be left in a million, 10 million, 100 million years? And the answer is a surprising amount.
It's funny because at first the juxtaposition, given your past works with regard to poetics, narratives, and in this book, I thought, this is a strange juxtaposition. And then, like some of our favorite authors, whether it's Italo Calvino, Ursula Le Guin, Baudelaire, William Golding, Daniel Defoe, a lot of it is either magical realism or science fiction. And I thought, wow. And then I realized that you combine these things. That's one of the reasons it's accessible, because people aren't usually confronted, not confronted, but they're not usually given this mixture, this admixture of literature, which is your background, and this concept of future archaeology. So as an expert in English literature, how did you decide to diverge into the realm of what we're doing to the planet, whether it's the rising of seas or global climate change?
Well, it's because, I mean, so much of the kind of the climate crisis represents not just a challenge to how we live, but to our imaginations. It's difficult to really get your head around the scale and the extent and diversity of the challenges that we face. The fact that it affects so many people in so many diverse ways, and that these effects will be played out over hundreds, even thousands of years in some cases. It's a challenge to our imaginations, and that's where literature comes in, I think. You know, it's, if you have a background in earth sciences, climate science, and so on, of course, it's perhaps easier to get a hold on, you know, the implications of what we face. But not all of us have that, and I think stories can do a great job in building that kind of bridge for us. So, you know, this challenge to our imaginations is something that stories, literature, poetry can meet very well, I think. You know, we that's the work of storytelling, is not just to tell us what is, but also to tell us what could be. And I think that's really important, is that, you know, thinking about what our material legacies will be, what our future archaeology will be, what stories these traces will tell. You know, we have choices to make about what that story will be. We can decide whether that will be a story just of damage, neglect, or whether it might be a story of care, of learning to be better ancestors. That's where I think literature really comes in. I think literature can help us imagine otherwise.
And the other thing is, as a perfect example, whether it's metaphor or analogy, is many times you talk about whether it's roadways, asphalt, concrete, or whether it's plastic, and how many times it could girdle the earth and the thickness that would derive from that. And you use an interesting story, which is the king of the road. And I think that would be illustrative to our listeners as to what we're actually talking about.
Yeah, so the first chapter of Footprints thinks about, you know, what kind of material trace will be left of the road network. There are roads everywhere. We've, as you say, girdled the planet in asphalt, and they connect us to each other, city to city, and city to mine and quarry. And so the roads tell a story of how we've kind of colonized the planet. The king of the road is an invented folk tale that's told in the middle of Ben Okri's, the Nigerian author Ben Okri's fantastic magical novel, The Famished Road. And it tells the story of this mythical entity, the king of the road, who's a kind of manifestation of pure appetite. He demands of the people who live close to him in the forest a sacrifice, but his appetite is so great that it can't be satisfied, and they keep giving him more and more, and he just eats more and more until eventually he consumes himself, and all that's left is this kind of aching hunger. And it's a really fantastic illustration of how roads are themselves insatiable. That, you know, that they speak of our appetite for natural resources and materials, and that we want to consume more and more. And so in Footprints, I think about, you know, what might be the actual trace of the road network, how much of our roads might last, for how long, in what capacity, but also what other stories they tell about, you know, how we've exploited natural resources and they've been carried along the roads that we've built, you know, that our appetites are equally insatiable, and that story is part of the story that we're going to leave for the future.
As an aside, I really thought it was unfair that the king of the road, as the people bring their sacrifices, he eats them as well, which really was unfair. And they should figure out, you know, we shouldn't keep going there, because And actually, one time he eats them before he even gets to the food. And
these are, like I say, insatiable.
And like the snake, he swallows his own tail, and all that's left is the stomach. But it's funny because there's this myth, legend, and then you switch to Manerdini when you talk about Edward Bertinsky, and that is photographic evidence of what we're actually doing. It beautiful in one way, grotesque in another. And it's funny because after I discovered him researching for this interview, I sent texts out to people and his website, and I said, look at these photographs. Most people wrote back, incredible.
Because you
can't see them in this interview, but could you describe them and what they are?
Yeah, so Edward Bertinsky specializes in large-scale landscape photography, but often of places where human industry has left a real mark on the landscape. So he's photographed working and abandoned mines, abandoned oil fields. He's photographed quarries. But he does it on a scale where they almost look like abstract art. He often takes these photographs from great height, whether that's from a helicopter or using a drone, even from a stepladder sometimes. But to the point where they don't seem like images of the natural world, but they seem very much like Jackson Pollock paintings or something. These incredible colors that you get in the Athabasca tar sands or in polluted mines. And what he's trying to do is give a kind of frame, a visual frame for the Anthropocene, this period of profound ecological change and damage driven by human influence that we now live in. He's looking at what is the, what's the iconography of the Anthropocene? And for him, it's at massive scale. And it's where this line between the natural and the artificial seems to blur into one another. And it yields some incredibly beautiful images, which is, quite an ironic thing because, you can't help but look at these photographs, often of profoundly damaged landscapes, and think, my goodness, that's incredible. I've never seen anything like that.
Yeah, and that was the word. And they look beautiful. And it's like a lot of other things in life, when viewed from afar, you think there's beauty. When you get closer, it's the grotesque. And which also reminded me, it's not exactly on par, but of Michelangelo's quote about essentially there's a block of stone and you're carving away everything that isn't the sculpture. And it reminds me of when I was in Florence and you see the four slaves, and it really seems as if they are very... they want to escape what they are in, and that was really good. Talk about the boreholes, especially the Russian one, and how deep it goes.
The Kola super deep borehole. So the deepest hole humanity has ever made was made by the USSR purely to experiment how deep they could go. And it's only a matter of inches in diameter, but it goes down just over 12 kilometers, which is an astonishing thought that, if you dropped a coin down there, how long it would take before it would hit the bottom. And it's nowhere remarkable. If you look at, I've never been there, but if you look at photographs, it's just got this iron cap over the top of it. But it's an illustration of how far we've gone in quite literally impressing ourselves. And I talk in footprints about, it's as if we've pressed our image into the earth, or inscribed our name collectively into the earth, because the super deep borehole is you know, one particularly superlative example of this. But if you added together all of the boreholes we've created for mining, for oil drilling and exploration, natural gas and so on, and if it was possible to lay them end to end, they'd stretch for 50 million kilometers. And that is roughly the same extent of the planetary road network, which is an odd coincidence, I think, but somehow quite a telling one.
Yeah, I think I think I read somewhere that 93% of the city of Los Angeles is paved.
Yeah. And even if only 1% of the surface road network persists, that, you know, given on a kind of planetary extent, given how, you know, networked we are, that will tell a story. And, you know, when you think about roads that pass through tunnels or, you know, deep underground, it's possible we'll have whole stretches of roads preserved in quite astonishing, and quite an astonishing state, you know, that might stretch, you know, a mile, several miles, which will, you know, will itself be profoundly articulate about the kind of world we lived in.
Yeah, and the other thing you talk about, which I'm somewhat fatalistic, but assuming hundreds or thousands of years from now, there still are human beings that are interested in exploring the past. You talk about what will survive and what won't survive, and that maybe they'll just be a strata like there are now, this thick, recognizing the concrete, and the fact that just as in glacial manners, it's almost as if this stone or this aggregate is moved, because all of our stuff is moved from China to the United States, and just like glaciers drop a rock and then move 1,000 miles more. And that's fascinating too.
Yeah, it is. And it's, we're a geological force now. We do what continental drift plate tectonics, glaciers have done in the past. We move things around.
What about, again, in invisible cities where you draw that, which, you know, it was fascinating because I didn't really, at first I thought, well, this is a weird way of approaching this. And then I realized, well, I understand these connections for, you know, Italo Calvino is one of my favorite authors. And the one thing that you talk about, well, you talk about Venice a lot and you talk about him a lot. And then you talk about the one time in invisible cities where he says it's hard to talk about cities without just going back to Venice. So tell us a little bit about why you chose that city. There's other cities that are getting underwater, but why Venice?
I guess because Venice is, you know, perhaps it was likely to be one of the first that will be inundated and perhaps have to be abandoned, and it's partly as well the place Venice has in the imagination of many of us. I think, you know, it's a city of eternal beauty and cultural achievement, but likely, unless radical action is taken, to be uninhabitable by the end of the century. I mean, if we continue on the current trajectory, I think Venice is almost certain to be only a memory. Only something that we talk about in the past tense. Italo Calvino's Invisible Cities is the most incredible collection of fantastical city spaces. And, you know, as you indicated, you know, Marco Polo tells Kublai Khan at one point in recounting all of these brilliant cities that he's visited, in some ways he's always talking about his home city, always talking about Venice. And that really struck me because on the one hand, you know, modern megacities, cities today, are equally fabulous as anything, you know, in their own way, as anything Calvino imagined. But, you know, so many megacities, from New York to Mumbai to Shanghai, where I visited, face a very uncertain future. You know, face as under threat as Venice is. And so it was a way to think about, you know, what might be the future of these vast, vast cities, you know, with tens of millions of inhabitants? What kind of trace will they leave? How does a megacity become a fossil? And, you know, as you said, I think, you know, what I discovered in reading the speculations of geologists on this issue, it's likely that a city like Shanghai will still leave a kind of meter thick trace in the strata, in the rock record, 100 million years from now, punctuated with, you know, the residues of concrete, steel, glass, plastic, and, you know, perhaps even the outlines of some everyday objects that we might recognize, which is an incredible thought, I think. And yet these cities exist on a scale that's so vast, so deeply impressed in the earth that it seems, you know, almost guaranteed that that trace will be there.
And another aside is, during COVID, isn't it interesting how the canals have cleared up so much that fish have come back and they're enjoying the their ecosystem? And also, I was thinking of all cities when I was there last year, it's just tourism makes the city work, and there is none at all. And that's irrelevant, but I just find it fascinating.
Yeah, well, the pandemic has a deep time dimension to it as well. And we are preoccupied with now, and of course, naturally and very necessarily, but all of this plastic that we're using. I've just written a piece that's come out in Orion magazine that thinks about what kind of pandemic layer, you know, there might be in, you know, in the Anthropocene record, you know, in the layer of all the gloves and the masks and all the PPE and plastic that we're, single-use plastic that we're using, so much of it is discarded in the environment. I'm sure you and anyone listening will have seen gloves and masks just dropped in the street and bushes. And that, a lot of that's going to find its way into the soil, and, you know, in enough great enough concentrations, that will form part of this fossil record that we're talking about.
You bring yourself and your family into the book from time to time. And the one section, or the one, basically just one paragraph, where you talk about how much plastic you use in the first hour and a half of your day. So I did the same exercise and I realized, well, half the stuff on my desk is plastic or more, or paper. And I don't think anybody actually thinks, and you don't either. You didn't either until you did the exercise, correct?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to present myself as some kind of paragon of virtue that I live a life outside of all of this. I'm as involved and culpable and responsible as anyone else. But then neither is it about guilt or, painting a dark, bleak picture. As I said, I think, my hope in writing Footprints was that, you know, we would begin to see not just future fossils as a way of storytelling, but as an opportunity to think about what story we do want to tell to the future. You know, what kind of legacy do we want to leave? And that's my family, motivated me more than anything else to really think about that question and come up with a good answer to it, because it's their future. So, you know, it might seem overwhelming, you know, how much plastic, you know, we all make use of in 1 hour of the day, or to think about, you know, the kind of legacy that our cities will leave in the rock record. But I think there's a way to look at this that is hopeful, that we have choices about the story that we tell. And it's about thinking about, you know, it's about rethinking how we're connected. Actually, you know, we think of ourselves as living in a globalized world where, you know, we are connected to people thousands of miles away. We're talking to each other over the distance of thousands of miles. We tend less often to think about how our actions and our, you know, connect us to people who live on the far side of the planet, how, you know, our energy consumption affects people who live in the Marshall Islands or in Bangladesh. And we tend to think even less often than that about how our actions affect someone who won't be born for 10,000 years, but that they will do. We are as intimately connected to people who won't be born for hundreds of human generations as we are to one another. And it's that kind of connectedness I wanted to explore.
Yeah, it's part of the space, space-time continuum. It's basically that. And it's like when you're talking about Venice, I was just thinking thousands of miles away, you talk about a much more prosaic city, which is Florence, which doesn't even seem like, how does this place still exist, you know? It's like, and like I said, when I gave the introduction, I was somewhat more fatalistic than you, but then I thought about it, are we past like the Malcolm Gladwell tipping point? Is there any way you think, you've given us so many facts, is there any way that we can tip back past it? I don't see any. We can't do it.
I think we stand on the threshold of multiple possible futures. You know, we talk about tipping points that would lead to a 2-degree world, a 2.5, a 3, 3.5. And each of these represents a radically different future for humanity and for, you know, for other creatures that we share the planet with. I don't think, from what I've read so far, that, you know, the worst case scenarios are inevitable. It's impossible to go back to a pre-industrial climate, at least on any time scale that is meaningful for human experience. We are going to live in a world, you know, profoundly influenced by human activity from now on. But it's about how influenced and to what extent. So I think, yeah, it's possible for us to change the nature and the terms of the story we're telling. It will take a profound level of collective and individual action, political will, the reshaping of economies, societies, and governments. But I don't think we have a choice. And people talk about the being put off by the cost of decarbonizing, but you know they really ought to consider the cost of living in a 3-degree world. It doesn't compare. It really doesn't. We don't have a choice. So that, for me, is also reason for hope. We don't have a choice that we need to get on with it.
Yeah, but the thing is that you've popularized, especially now in this book, the concept of an epic that's Anthropocene. You've actually created, others have created this epic, like the Permian, when there was this catastrophe that destroyed almost all life on Earth. And now you have the Anthropocene, and you're talking about the future coming back and saying, what the hell was this? What did they do?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a tacit assumption in Footprints that, you know, there will still be our descendants there to read the stories that we've told. The fact is, though, whether there is anyone left in 100 million years or not, and you know, whether they'd be interested or able to find our, you know, the fossil layers of our cities, to me, it almost to me doesn't matter, because it will be there. You know, The fact of having that an effect on that scale on the planet, which is, you know, unique in the history of species. I think it should give us sufficient pause for thought. But, you know, I am hopeful. I am hopeful that there will be human generations that will tell stories about us. And what I hope is that they'll tell stories about us as the generations that realized in time that things needed to change and turn the boat around before real calamity arrived.
Well, the other interesting thing, if you look at it from the concept of time, is that one of the things you do in your book is you don't say that these future archaeologists, anthropologists will make any value judgment about us. They will just discover what we were, who we were, how we created this, like, you know, rings on a tree. In a good year, there's more lines. In a bad year, there's less. And I'm not making a value judgment about the tree. I'm just noticing what was happening during that year or during that season. Mm-hmm. And I don't think you ever criminalize what we're doing, do you?
I don't think it's helpful to point the finger, wag the finger at, you know, I don't think that that's a way to draw people on side. I think we all know that what we're doing is damaging, and you have to go a long way to find someone who would accept the science on climate change and say it was a good thing. They do exist, but they're few and thankfully far between, if perhaps more voluble than they should be. So I didn't feel it was necessary to you know, lay on the guilt. You know, I think many of us have enough of that. And likewise, you know, we can speculate how a future generation might, you know, look at, you know, the weather patterns in the world they live in thousands of years from now, and look at the level of the seas, and then look at the evidence of our civilizations, how we lived and connect the two. We can speculate what kind of stories they'll tell, whether they'll be, you know, whether they'll convict us and condemn us, or whether they might be more understanding. But we can only speculate, and perhaps we, you know, it's best to leave that to the reader to think, well, what kind of story is likely to be told? What kind of story would I like there to be told? What's the legacy I want to leave? And let that be the thing that motivates us. You know, that's that phrase again, you know, how do we become good ancestors? I can't think of a more important question that we all ask ourselves right now. Not just because it, you know, we have an ethical obligation to the future, but, you know, the changes that we make now will make a profound difference to all our lives right now and the lives of, the, you know, our children and our grandchildren. It's all connected.
Well, not to beat a dead horse, but when you talk about Greenland and Antarctica, it doesn't sound like you're saying we can undo this. It doesn't sound as if, okay, it would take a gargantuan effort.
Yeah. I mean, some of the damage is already done, and some of the damage is already kind of guaranteed, baked into the system. You know, we will, even if we were to stop burning fossil fuels now, literally this second, you know, the seas would continue to rise maybe for 100 years. That, you know, the warming is built into the system through a series of feedback loops and so on. And so we will continue to see the world change regardless of what action we take. But it's about how much it changes and to what extent. And we do have something to say about that. I mean, there was a report came out, a UN report on biodiversity in 2019 that predicted that up to 1 million species could go extinct by the end of the century. Now that's a forecast. We get to have a say in how accurate that proves to be. You know, there's damage that's been done, and unfortunately, there's nothing we can do about that, or not much. There's an awful lot of damage that has been forecast, a lot more than has been done already, and there is a lot that we can do about that.
It's interesting. There's one concept that is at first glance is hard to understand, and that's the and I think it's Ursula Le Guin again, the concept about the idea of a basket or a carrier, and you talk about bags as well, but it's really interesting because it's, in my mind, it was hard to understand exactly what the meaning of that is, the concept of that and the bottle as hero.
Yeah. Well, so the chapter on plastic starts with Ursula Le Guin's essay, The Carrier Bag Theory of Fiction. And because I was interested in, you know, what kind of story would a single plastic bottle tell? You know, we often hear about how much plastic has entered the environment, how long lived it is. And yet, you know, I think still every day, in everyday life, we encounter so much single use plastic that it's hard to register. It just sort of passes across our vision and disappears again as if it's just suddenly gone. So I went to Ursula Le Guin's essay that posits the theory that the first tools weren't weapons, they were stone axes, they were vessels. They were vessels for, you know, they were a means to carry things, you know, necessary items from one place to another. And it's this idea that, you know, that the first vessel broke open time and space. You know, it meant that, you know, our ancestors could carry the forest or the river with them rather than always resources were. And she draws a connection between that and stories. Stories do the same thing. Stories are vessels. They're receptacles for meaning, for memory, for events, for the values of the group. And it was from there I started to think, well, what, you know, imagine, imagine a plastic bottle that is discarded unthinkingly, enters the oceans and circulates for decades, hundreds of years before it finally breaks down, sinks to the ocean floor in microplastic quantities and begins to, you know, kind of be enfolded into the sediment and gradually transform back into oil, its origin. And what kind of story might be told about the entire lifespan of this bottle? What might it be a receptacle for other than, you know, the water that it held for that brief kind of moment in its lifespan? And so again, it's about thinking about these material legacies as stories, which I keep coming back to, that, you know, they are articulate, they speak, they bear witness, they tell stories about us and the world we live in and the world we're making. So yeah, that's how Ursula Le Guin took me to plastic bottles.
Yeah, and that's how I started out, because that's, you know, I've always loved magical realism, from Gabriel Garcia Marquez to Italo Calvino, and then to the science fiction as well. And it's like, but then, you know, you mentioned about it's not, she's saying it didn't begin with weapons or axes, but you spend some time, I guess it's, is that with Eileen Fisher, when you spend some time opening the drawers and you seem fascinated by it? It's the, your fascination comes through the book.
Yeah, so I was fortunate enough to go to the National Museum of Scotland's storage facility in north of Edinburgh, where I live, where they keep all the stuff on display, and I was shown their collection of stone hand axes. And they're incredible, incredibly beautiful objects. Some of the ones I was shown were ceremonial, made of this beautiful green stone, highly polished, and, you know, they were vessels, again, axes that were vessels for meaning. They had a ritual purpose. I also got to hold a stone hand axe that was about 200,000 years old. It was the oldest thing object that they had in the collection. And it was really strange. I held it, picked it up right-handed. I picked it up in my right hand, and it just felt strange. I just sort of moved it around a bit, and I thought, this is just not working. And just reflexively, without thinking, I passed it to my left. And it was like electricity went through my hand. It just bit. It couldn't have been more perfectly ergonomically designed to fit my hand. You know, ridges for fingers, an indentation for the thumb, and it was like an extension suddenly of my arm. And I could manipulate it. And, you know, I was encouraged to put it down very carefully. I didn't do anything with it, but it was just this incredible moment of connection with this thing that had been manufactured hundreds of thousands of years ago. And yet, you know, it was right there, you know, it was amazing.
Yeah, I understood, because I'm left-handed as well. And so it's like, I've lived with scissors and irons. And when I was younger, since I'm much older than you, smearing ink on the page, because I was, it took me a while to understand it until my grandmother told me my left-handedness was the mark of the devil. And tried.
Oh no!
I know, that was traumatic for me.
That's unfortunate.
She tried to change me. I think she might have tied my left hand behind my back or something, but it wasn't pleasant.
I've just realized it's very dark. Should I put another light on?
Who, me or you?
My screen looks very dark from. Would you want me to put more light?
No, it actually brightened from my side. So
okay, good, fine. Sorry, I'm sorry.
I don't know why. Well, I guess to conclude, a lot of your work is academic in sense. Like if you're talking about Anthropocene poetics or post-colonial asylum or unsettled narratives, just in conclusion, talk about why you chose to veer off to write a book that, like Neil deGrasse Tyson, is a book that is accessible and that allows us to understand, again, as I said, through the juxtaposition of English literature or literature in general, and what we're doing to the planet, and how you can then allow the reader to access that information. And it certainly is different than what you've written before.
Well, I think you said it. It's about connecting with readers. I mean, my last book was called Anthropocene Poetics. It was a literary study of contemporary poetry, you know, thinking about how it engages with ecological crises, and, you know, intended for, you know, for you know, people who are interested in that kind of thing, but not for a wide readership. Right. I really value academic debate. I get so much from it. I couldn't have written Footprints without the input of hundreds of fantastic scholars and thinkers. I'm hugely indebted to that, and I think it's profoundly valuable for us going forward. But I also want to meet other kinds of readers, to connect with people who I think would appreciate to hear these kind of stories, but don't have access to those communities. So that's why I wrote Footprints. I wanted to meet more people, tell the stories as widely as I could, because I think these stories need to be heard. This is, as I said, the most important question that we face right now. What do we want our legacy to be? It will determine how we act in the next 10 years. It will determine how we live in the next 100 years, and it will determine the lives of people who won't be born for the next 10,000 and beyond. And that's why I thought, I have to step out of academic circles and try to speak to many different people.
Well, in conclusion, for me, I own an independent bookstore. And as many times as people tell me, in general, you can't judge a book by its cover, every single person who comes into my bookstore judges every book by its cover. And not only is their cover really good, but also if you open it up, the first thing you see is traces of a haunted future.
That's Edward Bertinsky photograph on the front as well, just in case. I should have mentioned that. There you go.
Yeah, it almost looks out of, I don't know what, maybe Alien or something, or some kind of,
It's a shipbreaking yard in Chittagong in Bangladesh. But yeah, we just really liked it because it looks like this kind of strange sort of quasi-geological landscape. It looked like eroding mountain.
Yeah, and when you were talking about that, I could go on forever. There's so many questions, but we were talking about ships and how when they are dismantled, at the end, there's very little left because there's so much copper, which here in the United States, you build a house with copper, in the evening, vandals will come and take all the copper out. It was interesting to understand. It's like a graveyard. It's haunted.
Yes. Graveyard.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I've spent a lot of your time, but I really have enjoyed that. And I could spend a lot more time because there's so many discrete areas, in the sense that there's lots of ways that this is happening. And even you would probably admit that you haven't covered all of them.
It's a snapshot.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. I've really enjoyed our discussion.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate the chance to talk.